Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner says while rummaging around a storage room in the office, he stumbled upon six mysterious boxes with the word Mumia scrawled on them. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports the boxes contain files connected to the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and the contents may influence whether Krasner supports a new hearing for the former Black Panther and journalist.
Prosecutors wrote the court to say they found six boxes linked to Abu-Jamal's case found in an out-of-reach storage room. They didn't say what the files said. A judge last month declared Abu-Jamal deserves a new hearing since a justice on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court who rejected his petition had a conflict of interest. Abu-Jamal has been serving a life sentence since his 1982 conviction for killing a Philadelphia cop. Longtime legal advocate of Abu-Jamal, Rachel Volkenstein, speculates that the mysterious boxes contain evidence that was intentionally hidden.
Because there's no question in my mind, even without seeing them, that the only reason they could have been hidden like this is because this is the evidence of the frame-up of Mumia.
The boxes the prosecutors found had the name McCann scrawled across them. That's a reference to the former homicide chief, Ed McCann. In an interview with WHYY, McCann says he doesn't know what's in the boxes, but he highly doubts there's information in them that the public doesn't already know. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, January 2, 2020, our first broadcast of the new year. Gus T's first broadcast since returning from Florida, the Cows counter-racist retreat in Florida, relaxing, warm weather, rejuvenating for those who were there, I hope. Moving forward, new year, May 21 to May 24th, Toronto, next Cows retreat. Get your passport. Price is $660. U.S. deposit of $400 by February 29th. You can pay the final portion May 1. The final portion would be $260. If you are a parent and you have a child you would like to bring to the retreat, as long as we have 8 paying adults, children 14 years and under, half price. That would be $330. You can do the same thing. You can pay half of the $330 on February 29, and then the remainder on May 1. Certainly you can pay the total on February 29, but for everyone, the price again, $660, you can pay it in its total on February 29, or you can make a $400 deposit on February 29th, and then pay the remaining $260 on May 1st. But Toronto, looking forward, we should have pictures and a retreat recap so folks can talk about the experience and whether or not it was worthwhile, why folks should maybe think about trekking north for late spring. But before we get there, this is the book club, Mumia Abu-Jamal, live from Death Row. We basically finished the book last week, but we still have The afterword written by Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney at the time, Mr. Wineglass. It's pretty lengthy. I think Thomas in New York and others were asking for details about the case. The afterword gives a lot of details about the case and the trial. So, yeah, and as I said, we would have done this last week, but it's lengthy. It's not as long as our normal segment, but it's long enough. So settle in, take notes. We basically finished the book, but this is all the afterword by Mumia's attorney. So we'll get more details on what happened way back in 1981 when Mumia was shot and charged with all of this and landed him on death row. Context of white supremacy, the one and only audio segment for the day. Afterword. The Trial of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Leonard I. Wineglass, attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal. In one of the most extraordinary trials in recent history, Mumia Abu-Jamal, a leading African-American broadcast journalist in Philadelphia, aptly dubbed the Voice of the Voiceless, was put on trial in June 1982 and sentenced to death for the murder of a white police officer. The case was tried before the Honorable Albert Sabo, notorious for having put more people on death row than any other sitting judge in the United States. Before ascending to the bench, he served as the under-sheriff in Philadelphia for 16 years. No less distinguished was the tough and experienced prosecutor who had previously obtained the murder conviction of an innocent man. After the defendant in that case had served 12 years for a crime he didn't commit, the district attorney's office successfully petitioned the court for his release based on evidence that indicated that the defendant had not committed the crime and following an investigation into the original trial evidence and testimony. The only inexperienced actor in Mumia's case was the court-appointed attorney who was thrust into the role of defense counsel after Mumia was stripped of his right to represent himself midway through jury selection. The attorney repeatedly sought to be relieved as assisting counsel to Mumia during pretrial hearings. It would have been impossible for counsel to defend Mumia effectively, no matter what his skill and dedication. The court allocated only $150 pre-trial to the defense for the investigation of the case, despite the fact that the police investigators had conducted more than 125 witness interviews. By trial time, the defense had succeeded in locating just two eyewitnesses, although aware that there were many more. In a desperate last-minute move, Mumia's attorney frantically tried to convince a key witness to come to court by calling on the judge's telephone while the jury sat waiting in the courtroom. The effort failed. While the prosecution presented experts on ballistics and pathology, the defense was prevented from doing so to the paltry sums allocated by the court for that purpose. On the third day of jury selection, the court barred Mumia from further questioning of prospective jurors. Reluctantly and obviously unprepared, his court-appointed attorney was compelled to take over. Although 77 of the first 80 jurors had heard or read of the case, necessitating a probing inquiry into what opinions, if any, they had formed, the court became impatient with the process, claiming that Mumia's questions intimidated jurors. Some court observers believed that the court's action might more plausibly be attributed to the fact that Mumia's professional training in broadcast journalism was creating too favorable an impression. Under pressure from the court to expedite the selection process, which at one point included threatening Mumia's lawyer with contempt, a jury was selected that included a man whose best friend was a former Philadelphia police officer on disability after being shot while on duty, as well as an alternate juror whose husband was a Philadelphia police officer. Counsel inexplicably failed to object or even make note of the prosecution's racially skewed use of 11 of 15 peremptory challenges to remove African-American jurors. He even consented
to the judge's summary dismissal in Mumia's absence of an African-American juror who had already been selected, replacing her with an older white male who refused to answer whether he could keep an open mind, saying he didn't think he could be fair to both sides. The prosecution presented its case in less than 7 days. Mumia was not present during most of it, having been removed from the courtroom for insisting on his right to self-representation, as well as the assistance of John Africa at counsel table. With his life on the line, he argued that he was being defended by a lawyer who was not only unqualified, but unwilling to represent him. Nothing was done to assist Mumia in following the proceedings, such as transmission into his holding cell or the provision of a transcript. Not only was this a departure from common practice, but it was particularly damaging since it was Mumia and not his attorney who had prepared the case. Without Mumia's presence or assistance, his attorney could only feebly attempt to cross-examine the prosecution's witnesses. That the police officer had been shot on a public street at 4 a.m. on December 9, 1981, after having stopped Mumia's brother's car, was undisputed. That Mumia arrived at the scene moments after the officer had pummeled his brother with his flashlight was also undisputed. Mumia was shot, presumably by the same officer, since the bullet taken from his body matched that of the officer's gun. Mumia remained in critical condition for a period of time following emergency surgery. Nonetheless, his case was rushed to trial within 6 months without a continuance. After announcing that he would defend himself, Mumia was given just 3 weeks to prepare his case for trial. The prosecution's case relied mainly on the testimony of four witnesses who claimed to be at or near the scene of the shootings. The court had refused all requests to have these witnesses attempt an identification of Mumia in a lineup, instead allowing him to be identified as he sat at counsel table or through photographs in his absence. The most damaging witness was a female prostitute who had a record of over 35 arrests and was serving a sentence in Massachusetts. She testified that she saw Mumia shoot the officer by running up behind him, shooting him once, and then firing again after he fell to the sidewalk. Previously, she had given a number of differing accounts, most of them contradicted by the other three witnesses. Another prostitute, who was working the same area that night, testified she was offered the same deal as the prosecution's witness: immunity from arrest by the police in return for her testimony against Mumia. Of the three remaining witnesses, all male, two said they saw Mumia run to the scene where the police officer was beating Mumia's brother. Both testified that gunfire erupted shortly after Mumia arrived, but neither one saw Mumia shoot the officer. The third witness, a cab driver who had pulled up behind the police car, was closest to the shooting. He told police that the shooter fled the scene before more police arrived by running to where an alleyway intersects the sidewalk some 30 yards away. The shooter was a large, heavy man, over 6 feet 2 and weighing more than 225 pounds. Mumia is 6 feet 1 and weighed a scant 170 pounds. At trial, the witness denied that the shooter ran away, insisting instead that he took just a few steps and then sat down on the curb at the precise point where the police found Mumia slumped over and bleeding profusely from his wound. The judge kept from the jury the fact that this witness had previously been convicted of throwing a Molotov cocktail into a public school for pay and was then on parole. He might have altered his testimony to curry favor with the prosecution or even out of fear. Another witness, a nearby resident, also reported seeing a man flee the scene in the same direction. She was the witness that defense counsel couldn't produce after contacting her on the judge's telephone midway through trial. A third witness, a prostitute, told the authorities that she also observed one or two men running from the scene, but recanted her story after lengthy questioning by the police. In all, four witnesses situated in four separate locations on the street, none of whom knew each other or Mumia, reported seeing the shooter flee, and all had him going in precisely the same direction. It's simply impossible that all four were hallucinating about the very same thing. Nonetheless, no investigation was made to locate or identify the fleeing suspect. The prosecution's theory was that Mumia first shot the officer, wounding him slightly. When the officer returned fire and hit him, Mumia, angered, stood over the officer, who had since fallen to the sidewalk, and shot him in the face, killing him instantly. None of the witnesses, however, saw it that way. None even saw Mumia get shot. The theory was constructed out of the simple fact that the police found both Mumia and the officer lying within several feet of each other on the sidewalk, both wounded from gunshots. Although Mumia's gun was found at the scene, he had a permit to carry a weapon because he had been robbed as a cab driver. The prosecution's expert claimed he could not match the bullet recovered from the officer's body to Mumia's gun due to the fragmented nature of the bullet. To add weight to its somewhat shaky thesis, unconfirmed by incredible prosecution witnesses, the prosecution produced a security guard who worked at the hospital where Mumia was taken for treatment. She testified that Mumia, an experienced journalist who had covered scores of court cases, openly confessed to everyone within earshot that he had shot the policeman, adding for emphasis, "I hope the motherfucker dies." But the officer who took Mumia into custody and stayed with him stated in his written report that Mumia remained silent throughout the entire time he was with him. His testimony, however, like that of the missing eyewitnesses, was not produced at trial. The officer who reported these events was on vacation when he should have been available to be called by the defense. A defense request to continue the case a few days until his return was denied. Not able to produce the witnesses it needed to rebut the prosecution's case, the defense relied instead on the testimony of 16 character witnesses. All testified that Mumia could not possibly have committed such a crime because he was known both professionally and socially as a gentle and decent man. When one character witness, the noted author and poet Sonia Sanchez, took the stand, the prosecutor questioned her over objection about the irrelevant fact that she had written the foreword to Asada Shakur's, Joanne Chesimard's, book, Asada Speaks. Then, with the court's blessing, he launched into a highly prejudicial and improper line of questioning about Asada's conviction for killing two police officers in New Jersey, inquiring, further, whether Sanchez also politically supported three New York men who had been convicted of killing police. Thus, the prosecutor insinuated that Sanchez made a habit of supporting police killers and that, by implication, Mumia must be one. In so doing, the prosecutor not only committed prosecutorial misconduct, but set the stage for what later became an all-out attack on Mumia's politics. The jury began deliberations at noon on the Friday of the 4th of July weekend. By then, they had been sequestered in a downtown hotel and away from their families for almost 3 weeks. Not surprisingly, before the day was over, they had reached a verdict, guilty of first-degree murder. However, they were unable to do so without first requesting, following several hours of deliberation, that they be re-instructed on the law of third-degree murder and manslaughter. Evidently, at least some jurors were troubled by the fact that, even if they accepted the prosecution's theory of the case, the element of premeditation was lacking because the officer was not shot fatally until after Mumia himself was shot, and then, presumably, as the result of an unpremeditated reaction, with the jury thus conflicted on the lesser charges of manslaughter and third-degree murder. No one anticipated this same jury would vote the death penalty. The key to understanding why they did lies in what transpired during that part of the case that followed, referred to as the penalty phase. It is then that both sides present evidence bearing on the issue of whether a sentence of life without parole or a sentence of death should be imposed. In a clear violation of Mumia's constitutional rights, the prosecution presented evidence of Mumia's background as a member of the Black Panther Party some 12 years earlier and his political beliefs as reported in a newspaper interview when he was just 16 years old. Beyond doubt, Mumia is on death row because of those political beliefs and associations. The ensuing portion of the transcript reads like a grotesque chapter out of the Inquisition. It began when Mumia rose at counsel table to read a statement to the jury, exercising the time-honored right of allocution that all convicted persons have prior to being sentenced. He was not sworn as a witness and did not take the stand. In his statement, he expressed his innocence and eloquently claimed that the proceedings were unfair. Stunned by Mumia's accusations against the handling of the case, the judge ruled that Mumia had made himself a witness and could be cross-examined in front of the jury. The prosecutor, only too eagerly, rose to the occasion. First, Mumia was asked why he didn't stand for the judge when he entered the courtroom. That irrelevant and prejudicial inquiry was followed in rapid succession by a series of questions about why Mumia didn't accept the court's rulings without rancor, shouted at an appellate judge when his right to control his own case was taken away, and engaged in a hostile exchange with the court during pretrial hearings. As if to answer these questions, the prosecutor read from a 12-year-old newspaper article about the Black Panther Party that contained, among other things, an interview of Mumia when he was just 16 years old. With his voice rising, the prosecutor demanded to know whether Mumia had ever said that political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Mumia calmly responded that the quote did not originate with him, but was a well-known dictum of Chairman Mao Zedong of the People's Republic of China. Continuing without let-up, the prosecutor asked if Mumia could recall having said in the same interview, "All power to the people." Again, Mumia acknowledged the quote, but insisted on the right to read extensively from the news article in order to place his comments in context. The article, which had previously been kept out of evidence by the court for being too prejudicial, included references to the Black Panther Party, the breakfast program, and the party's ongoing dispute with the Philadelphia Police Department. Having thus portrayed Mumia as a radical black militant to this nearly all-white jury, the prosecutor argued in summation that it was Mumia's political history and disrespect of the system that caused him to kill the policeman. The jury returned a verdict of death after being allowed to focus on the irrelevant quoted words of a 16-year-old and disregarding the fact that Mumia had grown into manhood without a single conviction on his record, had a family, and the abiding respect and admiration of the community. The appeal that followed was no less irregular. A year passed before Judge Sabo got around to formally pronouncing the sentence of death. Mumia's first assigned appellate attorney did nothing for an additional year and had to be removed from the case by the appellate court. His replacement counsel required another year to reconstruct events and file the necessary papers. Part of that reconstruction was an affidavit from Mumia's trial attorney testifying to the number of African Americans who had been removed from the jury. Due to the passage of time, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court disregarded the affidavit, alleging that the attorney's memory had faded in the interim. All relief was denied. only four justices, the minimum number required, signed the court's opinion. One of the four, Justice McDermott, clearly should have disqualified himself because he had been involved in a direct and personal confrontation with Mumia, but didn't. Chief Justice Nix, an African-American, inexplicably removed himself from the case, as did another justice, Justice Larson, also without comment. That justice had been accused of racial bias by the chief and was later prosecuted for a minor drug offense, convicted, and subsequently removed from the bench following impeachment by the Pennsylvania Senate. The court's opinion, a particularly vituperative 15-page document, possibly the result of Justice McDermott's personal encounter with Mumia, rejected all of Mumia's claims, respecting constitutional and trial errors. Sanctioned was the prosecutor's racially skewed use of peremptory challenges, the court's deprivation of Mumia's right to defend himself and be present, and the improper cross-examination of both Sonia Sanchez and Mumia. Most remarkably, the prosecutor's argument to the jury that Mumia would have appeal after appeal and perhaps there could be a reversal of the case or whatever, so that may not be final, was upheld. That precise argument, undermining the need of the jury to confront the finality of what they were being asked to do, was specifically rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1985. Earlier, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court had reversed a state conviction that, ironically, was based on a summation given by the very same prosecutor using nearly identical argument he made in Mumia's case. The court chose to ignore both these precedents and affirmed Mumia's death sentence. Mumia fared no better with the U.S. Supreme Court. It refused to even consider his appeal. However, that same year, it accepted and decided favorably a case in which a member of the Aryan Brotherhood, a white racist organization, complained that the prosecution had improperly used the fact of his political association against him in the penalty phase of his trial. Ruling that the First Amendment to the Constitution bars such evidence, the court reversed his death sentence. Mumia's petition to be joined in this appeal was denied without comment. Having failed to gain a review from the highest court in the United States, Mumia's only recourse was to challenge the verdict and sentence by way of post-conviction proceedings in both the state and federal courts, habeas corpus, in Philadelphia. These proceedings differ from direct appeals in that they are narrowly confined to issues not previously raised and deal exclusively with constitutional violations. For more than a decade, Mumia had been represented by state-appointed and paid attorneys. By 1992, with his direct appeals exhausted, he sought out and agreed to be represented by a team of progressive attorneys working independent of the state. Funds were raised domestically and internationally by people and organizations committed to providing the necessary resources for an investigation, expert witnesses, research assistance, tests on physical evidence, and legal fees. For the first time, the case was thoroughly investigated, new evidence was uncovered, and more than 600 pages of Mumia's FBI file was obtained following 3 years of threatened litigation. A massive 400-page petition and memorandum of law was prepared, setting forth 22 specific reasons why a new trial should be granted, backed by a large compendium of documents containing nearly 40 exhibits and 13 affidavits from key witnesses. By the end of May 1995, Mumia's supporters publicly announced that a petition for a new trial would be filed in the state courts of Philadelphia on June 5, 1995. The newly elected Republican Governor Thomas Ridge, who had successfully run for office, promising to expedite executions, preempted Mumia's return to court by signing a warrant on June 1st, calling for his execution on August 17, 1995. No governor in the history of Pennsylvania had previously signed a warrant of execution on the eve of a death row inmate's return to court. Mumia's petition now augmented by a plea that his execution be stayed pending the completion of court proceedings was assigned to Judge Albert Sabo, the same judge who presided over his trial and who had retired years earlier but was still sitting as a senior judge on a month-to-month basis to hear backlogged cases in Philadelphia. Mumia's lawyers vehemently argued that the judge disqualify himself on a number of grounds, including his personal bias against Mumia, so evident in the record of trial. However, under Pennsylvania law, the issue of a judge's fairness is decided by the judge himself, and Judge Sabo found himself to be fair. Thus, it was left to his former deputy sheriff, who for 14 years had been a member of the Fraternal Organization of the Police, the same police union then engaged in a campaign to have Mumia executed, to decide Mumia's fate. It soon became apparent that the intervening 13 years since Mumia's trial had done little to change Judge Sabo. First, he waved aside the local rules, giving the defense time to prepare for a hearing, and ordered the proceedings to start forthwith, even before the district attorney had time to respond to the petition. Only the extraordinary intervention of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court stayed Judge Sabo's hand, giving the defense a brief period of time in which to prepare. Then he refused all discovery requests, quashed a score of witness subpoenas, sustained almost all the prosecution objections, overruled those of the defense, refused to receive any of the exhibits from the FBI, jailed one attorney, and fined another $1,000. Despite these severe restrictions, the defense was able to present evidence that Mumia's trial attorney was ineffective, that the prosecution's case would have been undermined by expert witnesses had they been presented, that the death sentence would have been avoided had mitigating witnesses been called, that the alleged confession would have been disbelieved had a key witness been made available, that evidence of innocence had been suppressed through police intimidation of witnesses, and that false evidence of guilt had been obtained by granting benefits to those who would name Mumia as the shooter. None of this, however, impressed the judge. Within 4 days of the close of evidence and final argument, Judge Sabo filed a 154-page opinion on September 15, 1995, denying each and every one of Mumia's 22 claims and making 290 findings of fact, none in favor of the defense. However, in the face of an unprecedented outpouring of support for Mumia nationally and internationally, not even Judge Sabo could allow the execution to proceed as scheduled. On Monday, August 7th, just 10 days prior to his execution, Mumia was granted a stay, something that Judge Sabo had not done in his decade and a half on the bench. With profuse apologies to the widow and police who had gathered in his courtroom, the judge solemnly announced that he was putting off the execution until all of Mumia's appeals are exhausted. As of this writing, the appeal of the denial of a new trial is pending before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. While the time it will take for the court to decide the appeal cannot be accurately forecast, it will probably occur sometime in 1996. Should a new trial for Mumia be denied, he will then file a habeas corpus petition in the Federal District Court in Philadelphia with appeals to follow all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. The entire process could take as long as 1.5 years. In the meantime, it is crucial that the momentum of the movement to save his life be maintained and accelerated. In the words of Ozzie Davis, a co-chair of the Committee to Save Mumia Abu-Jamal, "We need Mumia desperately. At a time like this, we cannot afford to let them take such a voice from us without putting up a fight of enormous proportions." About the author. Mumia Abu-Jamal was born April 24, 1954, in Philadelphia. At the time of his arrest on December 9, 1981, on charges of murder of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner, Mumia Abu-Jamal was a well-known Philadelphia-based African-American journalist and activist. He was the president of the Philadelphia chapter of the Association of Black Journalists. The January 1981 issue of Philadelphia Magazine had named him one of the people to watch in 1981. During the period of 1970 to 1981, he was a widely acclaimed and Corporation for Public Broadcasting award-winning journalist known as the Voice of the Voiceless as a result of his news broadcasts on National Public Radio, Mutual Black Network, and National Black Network, and did daily reports on WUHY, now WHYY, and a number of other stations. From his youth, Mumia was a political activist. At age 14, he was beaten and arrested for protesting a presidential rally for George Wallace. In the fall of 1968, he became a founding member and lieutenant minister of information of the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party. During the summer of 1970, Mumia worked at the Black Panther Party newspaper in Oakland, California, returning to Philadelphia shortly before the Philadelphia police raid on all three offices of the Black Panther Party. While working as a journalist during the 1970s, Mumia published some hard-hitting criticism of the Philadelphia Police Department and the Rizzo administration, which also made him a man for them to watch. He rejected Rizzo's version of the 1978 siege of the MOVE organization's Powelton Village home by more than 600 heavily armed officers, and his tireless advocacy resulted in his being fired from his broadcast job. He had to work as a night shift cab driver to support his family. He was driving a cab the night of December 9, 1981, when he was shot and beaten by police and charged with the murder of a police officer. He was put on trial within 6 months, and on July 3, 1982, he was convicted of murder and sentenced to death. His appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was denied in March 1989, and the U.S. Supreme Court has refused to review of his case. A petition for post-conviction relief is now being prepared for filing in state courts. For 13 years, he has been on death row in Huntington Prison. He has been a working journalist from death row for over 5 years. His commentaries have been printed in dozens of newspapers. At least 40 are known throughout the United States and Europe. In January 1991, his commentary on life on death row and the impact of the McCleskey case was featured in the Yale Law Journal. In 1994, his scheduled commentaries for National Public Radio's All Things Considered, Live from Death Row, which described life behind bars in Huntington, caused such controversy that they were abruptly canceled, sparking intense debates across the country about censorship and the death penalty.
Context. Excuse me, get a little water here. Let's try that again. Context of white supremacy. So we are all done. No second audio segment this week because we basically finished the book last week. But as I said, the afterword was kind of lengthy, almost as long as our normal segment would be. So couldn't include that last week. Now we are officially done, cover to cover, live from death row. If you have comments, questions, thoughts on what we've read, done pretty quickly. This is not a long book. The number to dial, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. And we're just wrapping up our thoughts. If you have final thoughts, major themes that you'll take away from this book, if you know this is your first time reading the text, that's what we're focused on. We'll talk about the new book Next book for next week, we'll talk about that later. So suggestions and all that, you can email or talk, bring that up later. But for now, we are our last bit of time on Mr. Mumia Abu-Jamal. Folks emailed, I'll get their emailed commentary in as well. Again, Mr. or Mumia's attorney wrote the final portion of the afterword. So this was a different author, might sound a little bit different, slightly different energy in how we finish up the book. Anywho, folks who dialed in, let's see, Thomas in New York, if you have thoughts, comments on Live from Death Row, now that we are done, should be with us, sir.
Yes, sir. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Happy that you made it back to Seattle safely. I heard a lot about constitutional rights and prosecutional misconduct. Man, I hate when black people start talking about that stuff. He got due process. He called the writer of the foreword, who wrote the foreword to Assata Shakur's book, Wanted Cop Killer, to testify for him in court. Like, seriously, man? Like, you could, like, then he actually wrote an opinion during trial, which then allows them to put him on the cross examine because he made an opinion, which is just not very smart moves on his behalf or whoever was defending him. Pennsylvania, the most powerful Supreme Court outside of D.C. in this country, the original Supreme Court, Philadelphia, was the original capital. Very hard for the Supreme Court, even in D.C., to overturn a decision that happens in Philadelphia. They were there before them. You know, they set the precedent. Then I would say, I totally think that he's innocent. I mean, Pennsylvania has set precedents recently where they put a man in jail who signed a document that was supposed to be sealed forever, Mr. Cosby. So, doesn't shock me anything that happens in Pennsylvania. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you.
Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby. Was thinking about him earlier today. Much of a thank you for, yes, I'm glad to be back safely. Hope everyone who was down hanging out with us in Florida made it back safely. Other folks, if you have thoughts wrapping up, matter of fact, stop. Folks who wrote in, let's get that. One of our investors wrote in, thanks for including this in the book club. The analysis from you and the other callers was constructive for me. Number one, the last section mentions Judge Nix. We heard about him today. African-American inexplicably recusing himself from the death sentence appeal of Mumia. Judge Nix, oh no, was in a tragic arrangement. Cowbell. Maybe that played a role. Number two, during the 1980s, I worked at Rikers Island as a part of the support personnel during the 80s. Not as a correctional officer, by the way. They don't like to be called guards. This was during the height of the AIDS and crack epidemic. The reading caused me to reflect on my experiences. It was clear early on that the most important thing that happened multiple times daily was the count, the methodical accounting of all the inmates throughout the institution, between 10 to 20,000 inmates. During the count, everything stops, and of course, things don't begin again unless the count is correct. I thought white people were ignorant about racism, white supremacy. You can't be ignorant about racism if you have daily counts of your niggers. Make sure that we've not misplaced any of our Negroes. None of them have absconded. Seems like they've been doing that to black people for years. Don't they do that to you on your job? Where's that count at? 5 seconds late today, buddy. Doesn't it be a pink slip? Much obliged, good sir. Make sure I didn't miss any other folks who wrote in. There are a number of documentaries that are available online if folks want to get more information about the case. You can check it out, watch what has been presented, if you want more details about the actual evening of the shooting, right, and what people said about witnesses and, you know, all the details about what happened that night, I think there are quite a few. I think A Case for Reasonable Doubt is the name of one. Mumia Abu-Jamal has a podcast that you can follow. Yeah. Audio recordings where it's updated pretty much weekly. I try to include segments of his on a weekly basis, but you can check out where he's talking about current events, sometimes his own cases or his own health. One thing I do want to add, I've been listening to Mumia Abu-Jamal's audio recordings for years. I mean, I don't know, long time. If you've been listening to The Cows for any length of time, you've probably heard him on the compensatory call-in for, I'd say, a good 8 years, maybe even longer than that, but a substantial length of time. There were periods where I first was accessing his content via iTunes, and something happened where it wasn't updating. Can relate to that one. But the feed wasn't updating, and so I was a little concerned first, like, you know, I hope, you know, his health and everything and all that, but he was healthy. It's just the feed wasn't updating. Then I found out there was something. iTunes wasn't updating, but he was still creating content, and I had to go to a different site. Very important. Someone like Mumia and I was going back preparing for the program, and they have done so many things. Like, they attempted to pass laws in Pennsylvania to stop Mumia from doing speaking engagements. Like, sometimes they would have him call in and what have you to do speeches, commencement speeches at universities and that sort of thing. And so they were trying to stop this, and they would get the widow of Officer Faulkner to come out and speak against this. Like, I mean, it's amazing the things that they have done, compromising his health over the years. If there's anybody, Mumia Abu-Jamal, anybody who produces content that might be about racism, white supremacy, might have some constructive value to you, other non-white people, you might have to exert some energy to make sure that you can continue to access that content. You can't be a disengaged listener of the content. Like, if it was just, I don't know what happened, it's not uploading on iTunes anymore, I can't find Mumia, we might not be hearing, you know, his voice regularly and things that he's commenting on, which I do appreciate. But searching, find it. If this is valuable, I think this content is important, I'm going to make sure, if it's not updating, I'm going to make sure that I know several other sites. If I have to email someone, if I have other people, or we keep in touch, do what you need to do, because racists, they have a tremendous track record for denying, obstructing content for non-white people. Thought that would be applicable in multiple ways, but that is certainly exactly the case with Mumia, that I have been without his content for a bit, but caught back up. Let's see. I'll get a few of my notes from this week's section. I thought it was curious as well. I think Thomas in New York talked about the wisdom of having Sonia Sanchez come in and, you know, testify on your behalf for trial. This is someone who race soldiers probably are not going to think too well of, even though she does reside in the Philadelphia area. I think she's taught at Temple University. She might still teach at Temple University, but I think that is her part of the region. I could see how that would not help out, and maybe that should even be talked about. Like, man, is this going to do us more harm than good? I'm sure a lot of people saw her testify at Angela Davis's trial and support her. Is this going to help out our cause, or is this just going to make things worse for us? I also thought that when they said that Mumia attempted to have John Africa as a part of his counsel. And it's like, my goodness, they're fighting with him and Sue Africa and the rest of the MOVE folks on a weekly basis. Why would I want to bring him and think that that's going to make my court case better? I could be wrong, but I did think that immediately. And Thomas in New York said the same thing. Let's see. Other notes from... really, none of this is surprising. If you watch that documentary, I think the one that I mentioned, A Case for Reasonable Doubt, when they said that Mumia admitted to the killing, that the night he was taken to the hospital back in December 1981, that they, after he was shot, they take him to the hospital and he admits it. He's yelling, "Yeah, and I hope the motherfucker dies." And I thought, now that's curious. That's why I talk about the way you say things is interesting. One, we've heard a lot of Mumia over the years. I've read several of his books, not just this one. He's not really a profane character. You know, he doesn't do all that filth, florin, filth. He doesn't do all that. You know, he's pretty articulate. We read, I was complaining about his alliterations, not his profanity. Really? That's what he was after you've been shot and in the presence of all these folks at the hospital? Someone who's a journalist who has, certainly he's not an attorney, but he has some familiarity with law and, you know, making statements of guilt in range of an enforcement official. I mean, really? And it made me, it stood out as even more curious. They said that in the book, right? That one of the officers testified, oh yeah, he yelled out that he did it. I hope he dies. Snarled while he did it. One of the enforcement officials, white man, in the documentary comes on film and he says the exact same thing. That, oh yeah, the night of the, that he was in the hospital after he was shot, he stood up in the hospital and told anyone who would listen, oh yeah, I shot him, and I hope the motherfucker dies. And I said, wow. Verbatim, exact quote. Now, I don't know when this documentary is made, but that sort of thing stands out for me. Number one, if it's a statement that seems a little irregular, it's not the same way that a person normally talks. It sounds peculiar for their way of phrasing. And then other people are methodically, verbatim repeating this line every time. This is exactly what he said every time, every time, every time, whether they were there or not, they repeated the same way every time. To me, that seems like coaching, and coaching to lie. Make sure you get your lie straight. This is what he said. Make sure you say motherfucker every time, because that's what he said. But I mean, this is all standard operating procedure, particularly to have a black male. You've been in the Black Panther Party. You're in the MOVE organization. Of course the FBI has hundreds of files. They said that they got 400. They probably had 4,000 in Philadelphia. You've been involved with all these nuts. You're hanging out interviewing Sue Africa and John Africa and the rest of them. Been in the Black Panther Party. Of course, Ed, you're a journalist. You're on NPR. Certainly you are on the watch list. Of course. They had probably been planning for that. I think you had said that. They've probably been planning for this for some time, for what they're going to do to neutralize him, make sure that he gets out of the way. We don't need anybody else, particularly someone who might have a national platform to talk about MOVE or any other aspect of racism, white supremacy, and do it in a coherent manner that may continue all this nonsense. We had to do all this with the Panthers and the rest of it. Let's nip that at the bud, as they say. Let's see, what else stood out here? The word fair was used a lot this here week. Wowee. Wowee. And this is, there were, it seemed like the prosecution didn't have much of a case. I think they wrote about, there wasn't really a lot of evidence for a motive in terms of this is premeditated. He had plotted, planned this out for, you know, 2-3 weeks. I'm going to go kill that motherfucker. You know, all the rest of it. They didn't have evidence to support that. So you get all these folks who have charges, right? Somebody who's convicted, throwing a Molotov cocktail into a classroom, and prostitution and drug racketing, all these charges and things. And hey, we'll go a little lenient on you. You got, you know, you might be facing some time here. We'll go a little lean. You say that, you know, Mumia did it, and say that that motherfucker, you know, was going to kill him. Say that too. But say that, and we'll make it easy on you. You won't have to do much time. We can be brotherly here in Philadelphia. You know, you scratch our back, we'll scratch your back. It's easy to do those type of deals and get you. That's Bill Cosby, any of those. It's easy. White people can dominate and exert pressure on other non-white people and make them lie. That's what we talk about all the time. Sometimes you might be made to lie in a system of racism, white supremacy. So we want to try to reveal truth as often as we can when we are not forced under duress like some of these folks to lie. Let's see. I suspect by this point, this is 1981 when this happened, and there had been a number of successful Black Panther Party members. I think Tupac Shakur's mother, Dr. Afeni Shakur, and others successfully represented themselves in trials in the 1960s, 1970s. I think by the 1980s, whites had probably refined their code to cut down on that, at least cut down on the efficiency of that sort of thing. So you're not having some Panther member, you know, stand in there and ask all these questions and do everything and walk out of there free, to cut that down. So they had probably gotten better. By 1981, 1982, the time this trial, they said it only took 6 months. Imagine even that. You get shot, you're in critical condition and there's no stay. There's no, oh man, he might die. Like, whoa, we might not have a trial at all. We just have dead nigger here. Nah, we're going through with the trial, whether he's here or not, dies or not, whatever. We're going through with the trial, and, you know, he better get it the best way he can. Let's see. They even attacked the attorneys. They said they fined one of Mumia's attorneys $1,000, placed another in contempt. I mean, wow. That is what domination looks like. You have people on the jury who are already familiar with the trial and who have family and relatives who are enforcement officials. If race soldiers, if they really want you, this is what it can look like very easily for Bill Cosby or anybody else. This is what it can look like. Let's see. I could see how a lot of younger white people, or I'll put it this way, I could see how a lot of the suspected racists who like to pretend that they are not racist, that they are revolutionary, probably some of the blokes who would have been hanging out with Paul Robeson talking about they're socialist, and let's read some more Marx and you know, talk about the battered proletariat. I can see why a lot of younger white people would like this here book, Live from Death Row, because there's not really a hard critique of whites collectively, the system of white supremacy. There is a lot of that class warfare. He makes a comparison between the Branch Davidians and the MOVE members. I could see how a lot of the young white people, this would be a go-to, but like, oh yeah, and you kind of get a twofer, because not only you can use this to spread more confusion, you can use this book and it makes you seem like you are down with black people. Maybe this is another Sue Africa. You know, maybe this is another Saul Africa, John Brown, 21st century style, right here. He's read Mumia's book and knows all about it. Spread some of the confusion that way. And then by this book, oh, yeah, well, Mumia wrote it. You see, he's not using all that goofiness, what they're talking about, system of white supremacy. What does he see? He says, see, we got the proletariat, see? The Branch Davidians are in the same system of oppression that we are. We're right there with you, brother. This will be a white person talking. Let's see. Yeah, they don't have any witnesses. Just from the information that I know about this case, I would be surprised if Mumia participated in this shooting in any way. I think they would have had more evidence, stronger case, if that were so. Let's see. While I'm flipping, make sure I don't miss any of my notes. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I did want to say one thing when they talked about having Mumia on the stand and they cross-examined him. And it's, did you say in August of 1963, when you were 12 years old, that power comes out of the barrel of the gun? I think they said 16, but same point. That's why I think Mr. Fuller, myself, on a regular basis, every single word that you say, as though it's being recorded, written down, you might have to be called forward to answer for that at any time, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 50 years from now. You don't know. That's the level of codification that you want, because you don't. And I would say, hey, increasingly so, because this happened to Mumia in something he said in the 1970s or whatever. And then he's on trial in 1981. They didn't have, you know, all the internet and Wi-Fi, where everybody has a cell phone with immaculate video and audio recording capabilities and all the rest, not to mention all of the security cameras every 2 inches as you walk. Everything, or I won't say everything, but many things will be documented, recorded, your work environment, all of that. So yeah, be thinking, is this something that I want to say? Am I comfortable? Am I going to be comfortable that, oh yeah, on January 2nd, Thursday, 2020, I was, you know, talking about Mumia's book and saying this and saying that. If I'm not comfortable with that, then maybe I'll be quiet. Very important. You would be surprised how many times you might have to come back and answer for something that you said and exactly what you said. Let's see. very much, much of this would seem like the definition of a political prisoner. If we're going to go through your life and who you've affiliated with, they're not on trial here. And it's not, you know, that you did something. You participated in some aspect of the crime, killing Mr. Faulkner with your time in the Black Panther Party, just bringing up things that are totally irrelevant. That we know white people will look at it. Oh, my gosh, we got another one of these niggers. I thought we had killed them. Oh, yeah, he's got to go. That sort of thing. Easy in a system of racism, white supremacy to accomplish.
Gus, can I say one more thing?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Well, he was talking about the witnesses, and they kept bringing on these, he kept emphasizing that they were prostitutes or whatever, I think, sort of to put the doubt in the reader's mind of their credibility. But all I kept thinking was Daniel Holzclaw, because none of those women were, they all had a checkered past, and none of them were taken seriously. You know, we don't believe no prostitute. We don't believe no former crackhead. We don't, to make a case for them where they could drag them into court, you know, she's not a prostitute, she's a madam, you know, or something, you know, but just how they work it. You know, that's what I thought when that part was being read.
That generally, or I won't say generally, but that often is the case, where if it's someone who has some sort of criminal record, if we're talking about females, if they're in prostitution or some sort of vice, drugs, whatever it is, it might be, oh, wait a minute, I don't know if this person has credibility. Maybe the way that they say, I don't know if this person has credibility as a witness. However, in this case, apparently their credibility was not impugned because they were saying what the enforcement officials wanted, that, oh, yes, Mumia did it. I guess their credibility was solid enough to get him convicted. Let's see. I'll pause and allow some of the other folks who dialed in to give a thought or through. If we have not heard from you at all and you have thoughts, questions you would like to add, line should be open. Proceed. This is, again, our last session on Mumia Abu-Jamal live from Death Row.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. That was an interesting ending of the book. You know, the language that I was listening to, I might have to just read it because I heard a lot of bias is one of the terms that I was listening to. Bias, you know, I kind of equate with, you know, like white privilege, racial bias, they were saying. A lot of soft language that I consider soft language was being used in that sense. But I mean, a lot of technicality of the system of racism within the court system does become prevalent from what I was hearing in that particular reading of today. You just have to kind of, peel off metaphorically peel off the layers of the soft language that's being used. I think if the guy just used, you know, racism or white supremacy, and, you know, instead of using bias, you know, using power or something like that, it probably would have been a little bit more accurate. But I think when we started the book, I had my reservations about Abu-Jamal writing from his own mind, because of the fact that when you're in prison, your work is technically not your work, because you are when you're in greater confinement, your property is really, I mean, all of our property is part of the system of white supremacy, but it is strictly the property of the state of Pennsylvania when, you know, him writing this stuff. So I'm wondering if this stuff is being edited or if he's being coerced to, you know, not use the term racism, not use the term white supremacy, you know, as much. I don't even think, did he use the term racism? I'm not sure, but he didn't use it a lot, if he did. So I've had my reservations on him writing from his own mind. And also, too, being in greater confinement changes people for the worst. One of the mentions that Abu-Jamal had mentioned was the former leader of the Black Panther Party, Huey P. Newton, Dr. Huey P. Newton. And when he was in greater confinement during his time as leader of the Black Panthers, he also changed as far as, as far as his demeanor. Because when he got out of prison, you know, he started fighting with the other Black Panther. Can't think of his name right now, but they mentioned it in the book. But what was that? I couldn't hear. What was that again?
Cleaver, the person he was, Huey P. Newton was art. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem. Eldridge Cleaver, yeah. He was fighting with Eldridge Cleaver. And I don't remember reading about him fighting Eldridge Cleaver or anybody before he went into prison. He might have had some disputes, but he never, like, you know, got on a phone and started arguing with, you know, with him like that. So I think prison did something to him as well. But obviously, you know, like I said, when we're in greater confinement, you know, they can do anything to us. And one of the things that he did talked about was, you know, experimentation. And I know we've covered that a couple of times in regards to experimentation, you know, on prisoners. So there's no telling what they're doing to, you know, Mumia in prison right now. But I just have my doubts that this is, you know, from Mumia's thoughts, let's just say from his thoughts from, you know, 1981, when he was very, when he was a person who would write, you know, maybe write about something that was probably about racism, but I just, you know, I just have my doubts about it because he is in greater confinement and he is being closely watched. In regards to his actions and his writings. I think that's all I have right now in my life.
Excellent point about the editing for this book, even in terms of what information they allowed to be released. I mean, they can decide, as he said, the count isn't right today. No phone privileges. Sorry, tell Nicole Hanrahan or Amy Goodman or whatever other do-gooder white person is calling the interview today that we got to count our niggers again. Sorry about that. No phone privileges. No pencil privileges either, because he talked about that in the book. You don't. Maybe today we don't give you a typewriter. We're tossing cells today, so no typewriter for you. Also, excellent point about the experiments. We had brought that up before. Racists love to experiment with their niggers, and absolutely. I just want, before I get the other callers, I just remembering the grandsister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. She said people were talking about Madiba, Nelson Mandela. They were calling him a coon and an Uncle Tom. She said, how long was he on Robben's Island? What was it? 27 years? They said, She said, how, again, this is third-generation physician, general child psychiatrist. She said, do you think being in prison, do you think that would, you know, change your behavior, change your thinking? How do you think that would impact you? Said, the crowd got quiet. The energy shifted. A black male spoke up and said, I was in greater confinement for 5 years, and I felt like I was about to go crazy. Nobody said anything else. That was the end of calling Mandela a coon, at least for the next 5 minutes or so. Absolutely. Not saying it's, you know, permanent damage in it, but I mean, we talk about brain damage with football and a lot of other things. Man, oh man. End up in not just greater confinement, death row greater confinement. Much obliged.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter. He didn't really have to go as far as the rest of us, but good to hear that he made it back safely as well.
Yes, sir. I just have one question about the last reading. And based on some of the commentary that I've heard, it's somewhat in sync with these quote-unquote high-profile cases of non-white black people who are reasonably known for attempting to practice counter-racism that finds themselves on trial. Those who have been exonerated in some sort of way, haven't they have had one of these quote-unquote radical white people that was legally campaigning for them during their trial, such as the O.J. Simpson trial, the white male attorney, Huey Newton. I believe William Kunstler was somewhere involved with that trial. Several others, I just can't think of them right now. I think even the New York 21, it was either some white people directly or indirectly involved with supporting that case. As I heard before, you know, that with the advent of him bringing in other non-white black people who makes attempts on solving the problem, may have been not the best choice that he could have made, as opposed to I wouldn't turn it down if a William Kunstler or anybody else, if I'm about to go to death row or stay in prison for the rest of my life, and they are willing or able to support me in some kind of way, I will acknowledge it. That's sort of like a real long question. But anyway, I'll shut up and listen to some thoughts based on what I requested.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I think that is a common element. The do-gooder white person, sometimes it'll be a really well-known or white celebrity who intervenes to help out a lowly convicted, maybe falsely convicted black person. I think that was the case with Reuben Hurricane Carter. I think some do-gooder white people got involved with that.
Mm-hmm.
I was even going more current, like we don't have to dig back in the catacombs. Kim Kardashian has just been getting involved in quite a few cases. I know some people don't think she's white, but I mean, that's close enough to the same thing. It's very common, or I won't say very common, but there's a number of examples of that sort of thing.
Yes, sir.
But yeah, the do-gooder white person, and I would not turn down the assistance either. I think he included that. If I was in greater confinement, particularly on death row, man, if Tim Wise came and said, "Look here, Gus T, I think we're gonna help and get you out. I think you're in here. It's wrong. We know you didn't do it, and we're gonna help get you out." Man, brother Tim, let's bury the hatchet, brother. Let's forget all that. Justice, she didn't know what she was talking about. She was confused. Yes, brother Tim, I'm gonna take all that. That's exactly what it would say. Nobody better say anything bad about Tim until I get off of death row. Then maybe we'll think about going back. But absolutely, I would be doing the same thing. But sure, that can have a huge impact on what words you use, what words you don't use, if you're going to write something or attempt to get a speech published, or forget even published, if you think you're even going to get a piece of paper outside of that facility to someone. Might come down to what word is on that paper. Maybe we don't use white supremacy today. Maybe we have to go with proletariat. You say proletariat, Tim? Proletariat. I'll put that in. Proletariat. That's what it is.
Right. We are not going to be able to go into a system that they control and control thoroughly with a black glove, a beret, although that's French, the beret. Expect to come out the other end, to where someone seeks to produce a movie on it. It's just not going to happen that way. Unless, for some strategic reason, white people would allow it. I don't know of any particular situation where that's taking place, but if they would allow something like that, but that's not logical. It's not logical.
Following logic, just following logic. Let's see, the caller, do we nab everybody? Anybody else have commentary we missed completely? Victim of racism in New Jersey, did you have commentary?
Hey, what's going on, Gus? Yes, I had commentary, real fast. I mean, they got that black male privilege, you know, Bill Cosby, Mumia Abdul-Jamal. Real interesting, with all the documents that was being released about COINTELPRO, that, you know, cases like Abdul-Jamal, so I'm kind of tongue-tied, and even H-Rat Brown, like a lot of these cases are seriously revisited. I mean, just based off the revealed information of how COINTELPRO operated. And that's real interesting. And as you were saying, like the testimonies that the so-called witnesses, you know, they definitely do that. Last year, I was at work and I was subpoenaed, you know, to come to court. And, you know, even though I gave my account of the events, you know, when I was forced to take the stand, I was coached. This is how they actually want you to say it, you know, and they go over and over and over and over and over and over. So that is definitely accurate, you know, that the police officers, even the witnesses would definitely repeating rehearsed scripts once they got on the stand. That's all I got from them.
Codification. Everybody, when they use that metaphor, we all get on the same page. You can think of a script. We all know our lines down to the word, down to the letter, down to the punctuation mark. We know our lines, what we are supposed to say. Bam. Cannot be ignorant about racism, white supremacy. Gotta keep up with your lies. Any other folks, comments, questions they want to make sure they get in? Again, we are all done live from death row today. No, you don't even have a second audio segment. This is it for the book club today. We'll be moving on to a new book next week.
Yeah, I thought of Meek Mills when the firefighter brought up the white activist, Robert Kraft, you know, out down there at the massage parlor the week after, and got hemmed up. But and probably because he was out there helping these Negroes, which I think it was. But Meek Mills, they give Jay-Z credit. No, Robert Kraft called up the judge or playing golf with the judge and said, listen, man, that brother there, I'm going to make some money off of him. Let him out. And, you know, they worked it out. But that's a very recent case. And it's no way it could work any other way in a system of white supremacy. Their system of law, and it's arguably, I believe, it's the most powerful system they have over the people domestically, because we have no, I think Allen Iverson put it best, you know, that cracker got a lot of power. I mean, they could totally tell you, hey, your lawyer can't say this, even though he can, but not in my court, you know, and that's the end of the story. You'll be appealing it for 30 years.
Yeah, that is about the case. That is what domination looks like. I did also want to make sure that I got in. They talked about the date. I didn't know when the trial was, like when Mumia was officially convicted. July 4th weekend, 1982. This is in Philadelphia. They got the Liberty Bell, what they call the Liberty Bell, brotherly love and all that. And they talked about the significance of that, to have a former member of the Black Panther Party, someone who is at least in a friendly way associated with MOVE in Philadelphia, Sioux Africa et al., has been doing all this reporting, voice of the voiceless, and now is charged with killing a white enforcement officer. We convict him just coincidentally. It happens on July 4th weekend. Wow. What a way to celebrate. Just in time for the fireworks and grilled wieners. Yes. We're going to grill that nigger too. Yes. The symbolism of white. John Patash has that section in the book where he talked about that. Anniversary killings and the like, where you get an anniversary killing, put it on the so-called nations, countries anniversary. And he talked about, hey, we've been here. We've been sequestered from our families. It's July 4th weekend. I got barbecue and plans waiting. I'm not sitting around here delivering weather. I don't care whether you think the nigger didn't do it or that. He did it. He did it. I got to go. It's grill. We got things on the grill. We got things on the grill. Let's go. Nigger did it. We're out of here. Right on. Absolutely. And they said it was all the white. They went all over all the details. I just thought that was important. July 3rd weekend. The holidays of racism, white supremacy are significant for many reasons. Any other commentary? Folks want to make sure they get in. Questions, thoughts that came up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Henry in Chicago.
One thing that I saw, and I might be wrong, but when I was looking at researching this book, Mumia got a $30,000 advancement from Addison Wesley Publishing. Now, I'm a computer programmer by profession, and a lot of their books are, you know, from computer programming and mathematics. And that's why I was kind of like, you know, I recognize that name. And yeah, sure enough, they published computer programming books. But I was wondering, like, why would they advance him $30,000 and not somebody like Simon & Schuster, who is a big popular publishing company. So, I just had a question in my mind about that. So that's all I have.
Meaning, why would they do, in terms of this is a smaller publishing company, so they wouldn't have the $30,000 to do, or why would they even feel that he's worth?
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, because I mean, my thing is, throughout the history of their publishing, all they did was publish like technical books about computers, mathematics, and stuff like that, but. His book is like, you know, it's like a, if you look at their catalog, you know, his book will probably stick out, you know, metaphors stick out like a sore thumb. And, you know, you would see like, why would they advance him? Why would they pay for it? Not to say that they couldn't afford it, but, you know, why would a company like that, you know, advance him to $30,000 to publish the book? Why didn't like a big name company like Simon & Schuster do something like that? It's just something that I just, you know, thought about.
That is interesting. Yeah, sit here. That is interesting. I don't know if there was a bidding war over Thomas in New York.
Yeah, that $30,000 advance could have been a tax write-off for them. And then they probably looked at it like long-term. If this is ever made into a movie, they get paid. If, they talk about this in any way that they can monetize off of it, they get paid off of it because they own the rights to it. So it seems like a typical, you know, white supremacist move by the publisher and hold on to it, and then they can use it perpetually.
Again, I think by this point, too, racists, they had become sophisticated. Like, this wasn't the first time we had some Negro killer, cop killer, and a big trial. Sonia Sanchez has testified. She's a big time professor and writer, and she's already participated in these types of trials. You've already seen Asada Shakur and all the Panther trials. So they have already seen, like, oh man, this thing can become a circus, and can become a circus for like years. like, you know, we could make some money. Like, this isn't until the 1980s, and the book isn't published until the 90s. So I'm sure they could look at this and say, oh, man, we could get all kinds of money from this. And they probably have. Like, this book has been in publication for, what, 20 years at this point, 25 years? It's widely read. As I said, they have it at the public library here in Seattle. Like, it's a book that's not too – I think you can get this book a little easier than you can get Mr. Fuller's book. Probably a good investment for them. 30,000. These are, you said, they do programming and what have you. These are white people that are accustomed to doing logic, crunching numbers, as they say. Might have looked at it as an investment. In many ways, proletariat, all the rest of soft language. I think that was articulated. They may have looked at it as an investment in many ways. Any other thoughts, questions, suggestions? Right on. As I said, we do not have a second audio segment, so we will be all done. Double check, make sure I didn't miss any of our emails or anything. We did not have workplace racism last Friday. Traveling to the great state of Florida, and I'm so glad that we didn't, because I think I said last week, hey, I'm supposed to arrive in Florida before 5 p.m. We could do workplace racism. You know, it's not that far to get to the residence. We could get there and do workplace racism. Plane indeed did arrive on time in Florida. I think we actually touched down before 4:30 p.m. So I'm thinking, oh, see there, we could have done workplace racism, but whammo, traffic attempting to get from the airport. It was total gridlock. And if we had attempted the workplace racism, I would not have been there on time. So was the correct decision to make with the massive travel. But man, there were lots of people who wrote in a variety of things. Thomas in New York included, about workplace racism. Was not a good week to miss out, but we will try to compensate as best we can. Lots of emails. Wow. It was surprising, very surprising, but we will be ready to roll tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, normal broadcast time. Workplace racism Saturday, January 4th, normal time, compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We will try to do our counter-racist retreat recap once everyone has had a few days to kind of settle back in, myself included, get back on the correct time zone and all that, to kind of recap what happened at the retreat, whether or not it was a worthwhile experience, and, you know, what constructive things they will take from the hangout down in Florida. So we'll try and do that in the next few days. Also, the author coming on the program, Andrea Freeman, to discuss Skimmed, how they deliberately trained black moms to not breastfeed their children so they could have some sort of inferior quality substitute formula, they call it. She should be with us in a matter of days. New year, continuing the counter-racist grind. Let's see. Any other folks making sure? Anything else they want to?
Yeah, I think the point you made a few times today about you know, this trial is right in exact. I think that white people sat back, they watched them politicize these trials, and they said, not this time. And he was all set to have a political based trial. That's why he had the people testifying. He had testified. I think he was trying to make a statement, you know, as opposed to trying to get out and chill. And I think it backfired on them because they were prepared for it. Hey, we're going to set this up for 4th of July weekend, and we're going to get no chance for none of this stuff to matriculate. You know, we're going to put this judge in charge of things. He's not going to play. You know, he knows the agenda. I mean, they were all set up for it, and I think his plan was to have a political trial to put the system on trial, and they were totally up on it, and they prepared for it.
Codification. White people are not going to do the same thing, especially, like I said, they watched a decade of that. These types of proceedings, doesn't matter whether the black person did it or not, to have them come in the courtroom. Remember they had Bobby Seale, having him in a courtroom in shackles and gagged at one point? We're not going through any of that anymore. We're not allowing all the dramatics. And now you got a courtroom artist got to sketch a Negro bound and gagged in the courtroom and have all that on the 6 o'clock. We're not doing any of that anymore. We're going to get a quick conviction. That's why they said we're not doing any continuances. I don't care if you got shot. I don't care if you got a new attorney. I don't care if you got an incompetent attorney. This trial is going to be done and wrapped, and we are going out for fireworks and hot dogs for the 4th of July. And that is that. And if there is a book or any publicity, we will be the ones benefiting from that. We got the rights to the book and all of that. So, yeah, we have evolved substantially from the 1960s and 70s when we had our first round of this sort of thing. We're not doing any more of that racial theater in the courtroom at all unless we are in charge of it totally. And that's about you. I mean, you haven't really had anything like that since then. I'd say O.J. Simpson, but that's not it at all. And particularly when you pull out and look at the whole scope of that, like, yeah, that's not, I can't even remember anything even close to that since then. They don't even have trials anymore now. If it's a black person that's the victim, they don't even have a trial oftentimes. Michael Brown Jr., Eric Garner. Anything else folks want to make sure they get in? Grand. Not sure what sort of strategy, I guess, unless he had a really good, like they said, unless you got a really good lawyer, you got a budget to bring in witnesses to really pick that apart, that they don't have any witnesses, they don't have any evidence. You couldn't match the ballistics to the firearm. Like, you don't have anything except a few weak witnesses. And if you have a better lawyer who goes in there and does a job, you just pile away at those witnesses. What's your criminal record? Are you getting immunity for this? Are we supposed to trust? Is that how justice works? You come in here and say this, and now you don't have to serve any time for peddling your drugs or peddling sex and vice out in the streets of brotherly love? Like, that's, you know, that's what you want. Isn't that movie the one with Denzel Washington where he was an attorney in Philadelphia? Forgot that one. That was a good one. But that's what you want. High-powered lawyer to go in and do it that way, not... Yeah, I don't know, John. I don't know. I would at least want an attorney to say, I'm not sure bringing John Africa in on your case is going to help. The rest of my ideas might be totally ridiculous, but I don't think John Africa is going to be able to say anything that will win over the... Do you see that white jury up there? I don't think they're going to be feeling anything John Africa might have to say. Even Sue Africa. I don't think they want anything Sue Africa has to say, like... at all. Let's get out of prison, and then if you want to hang out with John Africa, you all can do a speech on the steps once you're released and all that. You can even invite Sue Africa. We're satisfied, everybody? This would have been a totally different read if Sue Africa had not been a guest on the pro. I don't know if it would have been totally different, but Dan, can't hear people.
Well, I question her validity now that he didn't mention her. In his whole book, it's like, well, wait a minute, that's what you were there for, all this, you know? So I'm really questioning her now, you know?
Well, I don't, this book, he mostly talked about 1981. He was in prison for the 1985 bombing, which she was affiliated with the group at that time. So he wasn't, it's not like he was around, right, and going to the house and talking and all of that. So, you know. That could be I don't know if she, I don't remember if she was involved with the group as far back as when they were having their first incidents in the late 70s or what have you. But you are right. He did not mention her name at all in the text. You are correct. Maybe she didn't visit him.
She wasn't stealing anybody's code at that point yet.
That could be the case. Maybe she just hadn't come on the scene yet. The legend. But yeah, this might have sounded a little different if Sue Africa and Ramona Africa had not been on the program to talk about their involvement. That great. Every time I hear about Move Now, I think about Sue Africa. Doesn't matter who's talking about, it doesn't matter what they have to say. Talk about Move, I think about Sue Africa. Confusion is lethal. What does it mean to be white? Critically important. That's something that this book doesn't really address at all. Understandably. Anywho, everybody satisfied? Grand. Reading is more important than watching television. I was thinking about that Clarence Thomas book even while we were on the retreat down in Florida His biography, that is one. I'm thinking about Harriet Washington. There are quite a few books. Dirt, a number of books. There was one on Nazi Germany. Have to give it some time. I'll think. I did my duty. I did the narration, so I don't have to narrate the next book. Pick out something that has audio. If we have anybody, you have free time, early 2020, and you would like to narrate, feel free to volunteer, although I would like to get a book that already has audio so that none of us has to do any extra labor. We can just read. Again, we'll be here tomorrow, Workplace Racism, and on Saturday for the compensatory call-in. If you have thoughts, books, suggestions, or other contributions you would like to make, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Again, much obliged for everyone's participation. I hope it's been a constructive investment of your Thursday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Man, let's do everything we can to keep our brain computer working well so that we can process logic efficiently. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.